I joined back in August. I work, continue to work part-time over at UCLA doing gamma ray astronomy, and that's just kind of nice to be able to do both. One of the things that I've really enjoyed about being at Reasons to Believe is that I get to do a lot more reading of the scientific literature than I was able to do when, you know, my job is to make the telescope work or to analyze the data or fix whatever problem. And so it has been neat just to be able to read the literature and just see the amazing amount of stuff that's come out. In fact, this last issue of Nature has a number of review papers on cosmology and all talking about the various things and how the things that we see don't appear natural. And you know, it's just, you get in contact and get exposed to this latest research that really is confirming that God is the author and creator of this world in which we live. One of the things that just came up recently, you know, we use one of the oft-stated principles of physics, you know, or rules or assumption at least that we live by, is that the laws of physics are constant. You know, we look out, you know, and that's kind of the embodiment of the Copernican principle to these days. You know, for a long time, the Copernican principle really was there's nothing special about the Earth. And I think you can make a strong scientific argument that that may not be the case anymore. But where that is kind of transformed to, really with Newton and some other work in there, is that the laws of physics that we measure here on Earth are the same laws of physics that govern the whole universe, and that by therefore applying those what we can measure here and looking out and making measurements of the cosmos, we can get information on how things work. What's remarkable about astronomy is that we can actually test that idea of whether the laws of physics are genuinely constant, or the things that we know about physics are constant. And typically, excuse me, one of the places where that's come up in recent times, you know, in the past 5 years, is measurements of these distant quasars that seem to indicate that the fine structure constant, which is related to the charge on the electron, the speed of light, and Planck's constant, something may be changing about those values as you look at these distant quasars that's different from what we measure in the lab. Now, as we've gone and scientists have looked into this deeper, what they found is that it seems this effect that they were measuring, you know, seeming to indicate that they were measuring, turns out to be caused by different chemical compositions. But, you know, it stirs a lot of excitement. Well, a similar sort of experiment has come out where they're looking again at these distant quasars that are shining through gas clouds, and looking at how the spectral lines, you know, basically as you got light going through a cloud, the atoms in that cloud will absorb specific frequencies of light based on what the properties of that cloud are, what elements are in it, how fast they're moving, those sorts of things. If you very carefully measure in the lab what you think that cloud is made out of and use these laser lights to see how it's absorbed, you can actually begin to compare, you know, way off in the distant universe, do we see things similar to the way we do here? And a group of scientists have done just that process, looking at a particular type of atoms in a lab, making detailed measurements. So, you know, 1 part in 10^5, 1 part in 10^6 precision on these chemical or these absorption lines, and then compared them with what they can find out in these clouds, and they have evidence. Now, let's see, evidence is a little strong of a statement. They have a good indication that perhaps the mass of the ratio of the masses of the proton and electron may have changed over the last 10 billion years. Now, why I hesitate to call it evidence, because, you know, if you read the paper or you read the summary in Nature and you read the paper, it's a 3.5 sigma signal. That means that the measured value of, or the difference between the value measured using our telescopes and the value measured in our lab, if you look and say, okay, what are our errors? They're about three times that error apart. Well, you know, errors mean different things in different areas. And basically, when you're looking at astronomy, you basically say, unless if I have a 5 sigma error or 5 sigma diverge or excursion from my expected value, it's, you know, you're a little skeptical. But once you get over 3 sigma, you say, well, hey, you know, this is a pretty good indication that maybe something's going on here. It's time to start getting a little excited and bring out some bigger guns and see whether it's a real effect or not. So what they found is that they have this 3.5 sigma detection of a 0.002% change, or 2 part in 10,000 change in the mass of the proton to the mass of the electron over the last 10 billion years of the history of the universe. Now, two things can be said about that. One is, well, we may actually be measuring a change in the physical constants. But a better, or a stronger statement that we can make is that at 2 parts in 10 to the thou, or 2 parts in 100,000, we see no variation in the fundamental constants. Now, my guess is that as we look at this in more detail, we're going to find that there's a little systematic effect that we couldn't quite account for, and that this result's going to go away, and that it will again establish that our laws of physics are constant. But this is just kind of a neat thing to see that scientists are developing techniques to the point to where they can really test this principle of are our laws of physics constant, or do they change over time? What this very clearly says is that as we're looking out, it's impossible to modify the laws of physics to get a cosmos that is significantly younger or significantly older than, about 13 billion years, which is, the latest, it's 13.73 billion years is the latest date measurement. But the laws of physics are sufficiently constant that we can be confident in 1 part in 10 to the, in 100,000 that we've got the right date there. So that's kind of a remarkable thing. So looks like we may have a question here. So
yeah, Jeff, I've just been reading a little bit about this cosmic string that they think they may have detected.
Correct.
Could you tell us about that, how reliable that might be, and what the implications are?
I'll tell you what the implications are, and then I'll tell you how reliable it might be. What the implications of this? This goes back to, we detect four fundamental laws of physics, or four fundamental forces. We've got the gravitational force, we've got the electromagnetic force, we've got the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. Now, we live in a cold universe, and it turns out that as you go back in time, as you heat the universe up, it turns out that these fundamental forces turn out to not be distinct. They look distinct now because we're in a cold universe. And the reason for that is that there are particles that mediate these forces. For instance, the electromagnetic force is the exchange of photons between charged particles. And so the photon is massless, so that tells you, the mass of the particle tells you the range at which your force is mediated. And for the electromagnetic force, you're dealing with a massless particle, so it has an infinite range. The electroweak force has a particle that is about 80 GeV, which I'm not going to explain what that number is, but it's got a certain mass, and so that tells you the range of that force, and that turns out to be about the size of the nucleus, a little bit smaller than the size of the nucleus. Well, it turns out as you heat the universe up, those forces become indistinguishable because you can now produce particles of that size or of that mass the same way you can produce particles of zero mass. And so those two forces that appear very distinct, the weak force, which governs the decay, the radioactive decay of particles, and the electromagnetic force, which is the interaction between charged particles, appear the same. Well, you can continue going back and making things hotter, and eventually the strong nuclear force can be united or unified with the electroweak force. Well, you go back early enough in the universe, and that's at about 10 to the minus 30 in that range, 10 to the minus 30 seconds after the Big Bang. Okay, so let's play the tape the other way now. We've got this strong electroweak force that's all one force, and as it cools down, the universe goes through a phase transition. It's very similar to, for an analogy, when you take ice, you've got this lake, and as you cool it down, eventually it starts to freeze, and it doesn't freeze all at once. It freezes in certain places. It maybe starts freezing here, developing a crystal and a crystal here, and as these things grow, you're going to end up with defects or places where the freezing didn't happen quite right, little discontinuities. Those discontinuities are of particular interest because depending on what the nature of that discontinuity is, it has different effects. If for instance you run into these walls, well, you end up with these big domain walls where if a galaxy happens to be moving through these domain walls, they'll just be obliterated. We don't see that, so we're pretty sure they're not domain walls. If there are points, then you end up with these magnetic monopoles, and the problem is there'd be too many monopoles, and those also have fairly deleterious effects in the universe. So you've got your two-dimensional walls, your zero-dimensional points, or your one-dimensional strings. And so that's what they thought they saw, was this where this plays out in the scientific observation, is that this string, or this one-dimensional defect, because of the warping of space in the area of the defect, you end up getting a very large gravitational field. And so it can serve as a gravitational lens, so that distant galaxies beyond it will be lensed. And if a galaxy or some distant object is being lensed by a string, it will have an identical mirror copy of itself. And that's where this particular observation comes in. Is this the particular object was CSL1, stands for cosmic string. I forget what the L is. Or that it may have been the telescope that they were using to observe it, but it's kind of a rather uninventive name, where they thought they saw this identical lensed image. Well, it turns out they were able to take the Hubble Space Telescope and take a look at this object, and it's very clear that they're not identical. And so the reliability of that is that it's well accepted that that is not a cosmic string. So while it's interesting, it's not a string. You know, and you know, kind of in the significance, it's not surprising, I guess, that it's not a string. It was kind of a highly improbable thing that you might find one. The fact that you found one was a little bit unique and exciting, but there's not a lot of them out there. So, and it requires specific things to be able to find them, so we probably have to do much more sensitive surveys before we're going to find them. It would have been a little bit fortuitous if it had actually worked out that that was true. So, nothing I've read about the WMAP has cosmic strings in it, but I haven't read all of their newest release yet, so I have no question there.
Okay. If I understand it correctly, when we look back in time, we can look and see where the universe was however many billion years of years ago when the universe first started out. At mm-hmm. least that's what Hugh tells us.
Okay.
It's always bothered me, how can I, being on Earth now, if we started here and everything was going out and light is always traveling at the same speed, how can I look somewhere and see back to where I was or where the Earth was? If light has always been going out and now I'm out here, how can I look and see light that is from, say, our sun eventually? I understand that it took time for the sun to form and the light. Do you understand the kind of question I'm getting at? How can I look back in time and see where I was if I'm here now? Why hasn't the light kind of passed us?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, it's Southern California is probably a bad place to do this, but if you've ever seen a good lightning storm, mm-hmm. You're sitting there and you see the flash of light immediately.
Right.
Now, if you can only hear, though, you only hear the thunder, say, a second later. And you know that the speed of sound is 300 and some odd meters per second. So basically every 5 seconds, or every, I think every second amounts to, some distance of time. And so it's 5 seconds is about a mile away. Now, if you only hear the sound, what you're listening to is the way things appeared 1 second ago. You're not hearing what's actually happening right there.
Right.
Okay. Similarly, light takes time to travel. So if I say I want to look at I am seeing light that is coming from the sun. I know the sun, it takes light 8 minutes to get
right.
here.
Right.
Now, what I am looking at right now is the sun as it appeared 8 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. I can't get any information on how the sun appeared 3 years ago.
Right.
Or I'd have to wait to get any time in the future. So you're looking at a specific instant in time, but it's taken a particular amount of time, determined solely by the distance, mm-hmm. for that information to get to you.
Right.
So it's the light from that object is continually flowing past you. You're just sampling it at a given point in time.
Right.
And that given point in time happens to not be the present. It's as it looked some time ago.
Right.
I'm still not getting your question then. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm picturing the universe is infinitely small, and then all the light is kind of going off straight because light travels straight.
Okay.
And so I'm over here. How am I seeing, first of all, the light that was going off in the other direction? Because if everything is moving off straight, then if I'm over here, the light isn't going to be hitting me from the light that happened at the creation isn't going to be hitting me.
What's going on? I think I may have a better shot at it this time. The earliest light that we can see is actually the light from the cosmic microwave background radiation when the universe was 400,000 years old. What went on in that event was before 400,000 years, you couldn't have stable nuclei. And so all of your you couldn't have stable atoms.
400,000 years?
Yes. The reason why is it was too hot. And so what that too hot will do is it will take all the electrons and strip them off, mm-hmm. and all you'll end up with is these charged nuclei. Now, in that state, light will interact very strongly with all of that matter. So whereas we live in a room full of atoms and a beam of light can go all the way across really without interacting, if you take this and make it a charged, ionize it and make it into a plasma, that will no longer be true. The light can only get so far, and then it's scattered, and it'll go different directions and sort of bounce around. So what you end up seeing is instead of saying, oh, I can see that object over there, is I can just see this haze of light that's coming at me from all different directions. Okay. So if you were to take where we were located in that microwave background at some point in time, every direction you look, you would see identically the same thing. It would just be this haze of light. Well, now, at that point in time, it cools down, you can form atoms, and now light can stream through the universe. Okay. So now you can begin to ask questions of saying, okay, the light that I'm seeing from there actually came from over there. Before that, this light that came here may have originated from who knows where. It made it isotropic. It made it so that it came from every direction in the same way. Now I can identify, oh, I see that star. I only see the light from that star that pointed directly at me, though.
Okay.
And so what you're seeing now is that before 400,000 years, the light from that star would have been scattered and gone everywhere. But now, after 400,000 years, the universe has cooled, and the light from that star can now make a straight line path to you, and you can detect it depending on how far away it was. You're not going to see the light from that star that went off in other directions.
Then
is that
what
closer?
Much closer, but then looking at 400,000 years versus 13 billion, how can we say then that we look at something that happened at the creation, these newly formed galaxies and the like that we say was happening 12, 13 billion years ago?
Well, there's a particular signature of that cosmic, particular signatures of that cosmic microwave background that tells us when it had to be formed. Among other things, it's the same temperature no matter where you look.
Okay.
So you had to be small enough that it could all communicate with itself. So it had to be very early. We can measure and it shows a certain temperature, and we know that it matches what we would expect from the Big Bang. And so there's multiple lines of evidence that says that this came from 13.7 billion years ago. And the reason we measure the temperature now is because you've taken this thing that was a certain temperature and therefore gave off a certain wavelength of light, and you've increased its volume, so its temperature went down, and that's why we see it at the temperature it is, because the universe has expanded, its temperature has gone down, and it now shows up as 2.7 Kelvin. When it was originally emitted, though, it was 3,000 Kelvin.
Okay.
So it's just as the universe has expanded, the wavelengths have been stretched out, and that means that it's got a lower energy now than when it was emitted, simply because the universe has expanded.
That helps. I'll think on that.
Okay.
My question is very closely related to hers, and it may be what she's trying to ask.
Okay.
So I'm going to give it a shot. And this is something I've always struggled with, too. I picture the Big Bang as an explosion.
Okay.
And two things come out of the Big Bang when it starts to explode. The matter in the Big Bang starts to... It all increases in size and starts to come out from what was the center of that explosion.
Okay.
Also, the photons of light after 400,000 years start to come out.
Okay.
Now, it seems to me that the photons of light should be traveling faster than the matter as it explodes. So they would have passed us a long time ago. So how is it we can still see the cosmic microwave background radiation from the Big Bang when it should be a lot farther out than we are in the explosion?
Okay.
Is that what you're trying to ask?
Okay. I think part of that may be related to an inaccurate picture of what the Big Bang is. It's tempting, and I think there's still a remnant of this thought that you've got this explosion of matter out into something. And in reality, what you have is you have this space-time matter and energy, which is really all the same stuff, where you've got space is what's expanding. Okay, so the reason why these distant galaxies are moving away from us has nothing to do with their motion. It's the fact that space is being stretched. So what determines, and there's two speeds that you have to worry about here. One is, how fast does light travel through space? And that's the speed of light. And that's a constant. The other is, how fast has something moved away from you because the universe is expanding, because space is being stretched? It turns out that for something that is... I think I get your question. I'm trying to figure out how to explain it now. What determines how long that light takes to get from you to here is the distance between you. Now, if space is expanding and light is traveling through space, as you expand space, it's going to take that light a while to get to you. Now, basically what it's saying is that light, when it was emitted from us, the total distance between where it was when it was emitted and where we are now is 13 billion years, 13 billion light years. So that space has stretched that much in that time. And so therefore it's taken that photon that long to get here. We may well have been much closer when it was emitted, but because the distance has been stretched as it's going along, the distance between where it was when it was emitted and where we are when we see it is 13 billion light years. Okay? So therefore, by definition, it took... I'm not getting at your question. And
it seems like we're... How is it we're closer to further out that we can see that photon from the cosmic background radiation that's been traveling at the speed of light for 13.7 billion years? How is it we're further out so that we can stop and turn around and look and see it come to us? How is it we got out there faster?
No, it's not that we got out there faster than it did, is that what we're able to see essentially is the surface of things that were emitted 13.2 billion light or 13.7 billion light years ago. We're able to see that surface. We can't see the surface that if you take and say, okay, we're here and we draw this surface that is 13.7 billion light years in diameter. And then you say, okay, let's run the history of the universe and ask what is it that we're looking at that point in time? It turns out that that's when the universe had just gone through this transition from atoms or from no atoms to atoms, and light was able to stream toward us. It turns out that those those cosmic or the CMB photons, what we call CMB photons now, were going everywhere. They filled the universe. We're selecting out a certain set that happened to be 13.7 billion years ago. If we had made that measurement 3 billion years ago, we would have still seen a homogeneous isotropic cosmic microwave background, but we would have detected photons that had a higher temperature because we would have seen them from a different time. Because then we would have been looking 10 billion years ago. Now we're looking 13 billion years ago, but they pervaded the universe, so you're just selecting which of them you happen to see based on how long it's taken to get here. You know, if we make that same measurement 20 billion years in the future, we're looking at a different set of cosmic microwave background photons, which will have a different temperature. No. Think on that last couple of questions and ask again if it...
Okay. A simple question. Quasars.
Okay.
Could you give us the what, when, why, where, how, you know, all about quasars?
What the prevailing picture of quasars are is very early in the universe. Typically where we see quasars are very different. They're distant objects in the universe, and probably what they are is how galaxy formation occurred very early in the universe. And our best picture to this date is that when you're having early galaxy formation, you've got this cloud of gas that's collapsing down to form a galaxy. Just due to angular momentum constraints, you end up getting most of the material being compressed into a disk. The same way our solar system has everything pretty much in a disk around the rotation axis. And then as that gas swirls around, it's attracted into the center, and you end up forming a very massive black hole there, massive being, you know, 100 million times the mass of the sun. And so it's this immensely massive black hole. You've got this disk of material swirling around it, and the dynamics of how that works is you end up getting these jets of material sprayed out that are going at near the speed of light. Okay, so a quasar, if you now take that object, you know, so that's the picture. You've got this massive black hole, big disk of material, jets pointing out. You take and you say, okay, let's tip that quasar and look right down that jet axis. You end up getting it's a very distant object, so it appears like a point, and you get immense amounts of radiation because all of that radiation is beamed forward towards you. And so that's basically what a quasar is, and it's fed by all this material being dumped onto the central black hole is what's driving most of the radiation that we see from them.
Were they formed like early in the universe's...
To get a quasar, you need at least two conditions. One is you have to have a massive black hole in the center, and those look like they formed relatively early in the universe. And then you also have to have a bunch of gas to feed the black hole. You know, we have a massive black hole at the center of our galaxy. I think it's about 400 million solar masses. But there's no gas to feed it, so therefore we see no quasar activity. If you were to take a bunch of gas, fill our galaxy up with a gas similar to when it was first formed, you would probably trigger quasar formation. But that appears to be an early universe property, and it's an early period of galaxy formation.
All right, sort of getting back on Marlene's question. So that they were formed early when the universe was much smaller, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And we're looking at them, and they're like, I don't know, 10 billion light years away or something like that. They're pretty far out there.
Yeah, they're to 10 billion, yes.
So we're seeing them, though. I mean, theoretically, they don't exist now in our time. Is that correct? We're seeing light from...
Probably not. I mean, you know, again, we don't have a picture of the universe as it appears today.
Okay.
Except for what we see locally. You know, the best picture of the universe as it appears today is what we see very close to us.
Mm-hmm.
But as we look back in the past, we see this period of quasar formation, and then they appear to, you know, you don't see them particularly close. So it appears that that's not the way things are working today. But it's not because anything fundamental has changed. It's the environment has changed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell me what you think ghosts are and what the point or purpose would be for someone who might have experienced that.
Having not studied this a lot, I'm speaking basically on what I've heard a few talk about this in his study, is that anything that's kind of a genuine, what would be a genuine ghost is probably some sort of demonic activity. And for those who are experiencing that, probably they have some tie to the occult, which has allowed that, you know, you basically have given it permission to be there in some way. And that's about all I feel comfortable saying about that. I really haven't studied it well enough, but that seems the most consistent explanation. You know, and it's consistent with Scripture. You know, we see demonic activity at work throughout the record of Scripture, and so we would expect that to be going on today. It's maybe a little less common, and particularly in our society, because of the Judeo-Christian basis and some of the way we've set up our society is all. Okay.
I've always found it fascinating with the film Ghostbusters that we actually have a Holy Ghost. So. the high energy physics have fascinated me because of the different types of maybe gamma radiation bursts that can come from different sudden events, and if close enough by our Earth, wipe out life. And maybe I'm wondering if you've ever just wondered or just sort of thought about if there's any possibility that at these events of mass extinctions, which many of them are considered to be a heavenly body hitting the Earth, if some of them could have been caused by that type of high burst radiation over such a short period of time that maybe they just wiped out half of the Earth as it rotated, leaving the other half with a lot of species then to differentiate again. And what I'm trying to say is, have you ever wondered if this figures in filling in the gap question?
There is an article published in, or a pair of articles published in the Astrophysical Journal within the last year and a half by Adrian Malott, a physicist at the University of Kansas, one of his graduate students, Brian Thomas, and you know, a couple other geologists and atmospheric physicists, who basically are positing that there was that one of the mass extinctions, and I'm trying to remember which one it was. I want to say it's the KT extinction, but it's the Ordovician extinction. They're positing that was caused by a gamma ray burst because of its signature, that it seems to have wiped out, or it's the extinction appears to be worst the more interaction you have with the atmosphere, and the further you go into the Earth, the less it appears to affect it. And you know, they make arguments and show that if, you know, they say it's relatively probable that over the past billion years we've had a gamma ray burst go off in our galaxy that would have caused something like this. And the effect is you get this intense burst. You know, these bursts last for on order of microseconds or milliseconds to you know, a few minutes. So it is a very brief burst, but it's very intense. You know, these things will outshine the universe in terms of intensity. So they're very bright, very intense. They're very high energy X-rays and gamma ray radiation that will do tremendous damage to the atmosphere, and it takes the atmosphere a long time to recover. And you know, what they're saying is, depending on where that gamma ray burst might have happened, if it happened at the mid-latitudes, it would affect the whole Earth. If it happened at the higher latitudes, it might just affect that hemisphere. And so they're saying, you know, that this is definitely an effect that needs to be considered. And they've actually posited that one of these gamma ray bursts caused the Ordovician extinction. More recent papers have argued, you know, it seems that all these gamma ray bursts are only happening in metal rich or in metal poor environments. So they only come from metal poor stars, which is typically older in the universe. And so maybe they're a less common phenomena. That also seems pretty consistent with the fact that all the gamma ray bursts we can definitively determine their distances are out at cosmological distances, you know, a few billions of light years away. So the more metal-rich the universe has become, the less frequent they've become. That seems to be consistent. But that being said, I'll put it at this, that yes, people are thinking very much about that, trying to evaluate, is that going on? How would we measure that? What sort of effect does that have? You know, could God have used that as part of driving, you know, the way a particular extinction would work? And so, yes, that's very much going on, and it seems to have a fair bit, or you know, it's a very scientifically credible idea and discussed idea.
Let me follow up on the great mystery question our class keeps hitting on is what does the universe look like in light travel? And let me just throw this mix in and maybe it'd be a good discussion for a future skeptics forum or for to try to visualize how a universe is three dimensions and a dimension of time and what that time dimension might do to how we conceive how light comes to us. Mix that with space fabric stretching that you mentioned, that actually the not the Big Bang, we might call it the Big Burn, to where as it expands, it is the universe, and the space fabric is something that I don't understand, but apparently has the ability through motion to turn into mass, and from that motion and mass have time, the third entity. Mix that all together, and we seem to be in a window, as Hugh would put it, of time, that we somehow can see the light, well, the matter that has been expanded out with, as a result of space fabric, faster than the speed of light, and now by the speed of light has just started to reach up to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have given this privilege to see the beginning from the end. But it's confusing. Just
okay.
Yeah, and so if some future time somebody could sort of work on that and visualize it for us, it's one question I find other people are trying to ask too.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, it sounds like this idea of figuring out how to illustrate what we're seeing and how we see what we see is a catch point here. And like I said, I'm working here.
So. Kind of on the same question, yeah. But it's a little different. We're looking towards the beginning, and not you have all this evidence about the Big Bang. Okay, mm-hmm. We're out in this universe that we're looking at. We're so far out.
Okay.
What happens if you turn around and look 180 degrees out of the direction? Can you see beyond where we're going, or?
Okay, I think maybe this is where the misconception is that the beginning happened everywhere in the universe simultaneously. You know, we're looking, you know, our picture is the universe, there's some place in our universe where there was a beginning. What the beginning was the creation of space-time, and that happened everywhere at once. You know, all of the space-time came into existence at the same time.
So there were multiple spots where it started, or one single spot where it started?
Maybe this might be a better way. We cannot locate, given our three dimensions of space, we cannot locate where the beginning was. Now take, for instance, a balloon. You say, okay, I've got two dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And what that time, how we measure that time, is how big the balloon is. Now we're able to actually measure that, you know, the time by let me come back. No, that's going to confuse. So we've got this balloon that has two dimensions of space, and that time is how big it is. Now, where was the beginning? If you only have the capacity to measure things in that two-dimensional space, there is no beginning. Okay. But now you say, okay, let's run the experiment backwards. The balloon gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and at some point in time, that whole balloon is at the beginning. Okay? So now let's go back and say, okay, we've got our universe out here, and this universe is big, so we don't have to worry about traversing a complete loop of it. But now what you say, okay, I'm making a measurement here, and what I'm doing is as I'm looking out, what I'm doing is I'm looking at the balloon when it was at smaller and smaller sizes. And so I'm not looking, you know, if it doesn't matter which direction I look, I'm perpetually looking back at the past. You know, the balloon gets smaller no matter which direction I look, because I'm always getting closer and closer to the past no matter which direction I look. So there isn't, oh, the beginning's there, what happens if I look that way? It's the beginning's there, the beginning's there, the beginning's there. You know, I mean, it's no matter which direction I look. And so if we have this balloon that is now 13, or, you know, whatever size it is, when I say we're looking back 13.7 billion years, what we're doing is we're looking back to the balloon when it was a certain size, but we see all of space there. Okay, does that give you a little different picture of how to look at it? That may answer your question more than your question, but... Well, if you look at it this way, as I look out this way, I'm going to see a particular spot on that balloon when it was a smaller size. So I have to look there to get that spot. I have to look there to get that spot. I have to look there to get that spot. So I map out the whole sky, and that tells me what that spot, that thing looked like. Okay? So now, I don't think I got your question, but I just... That occurred to me a better way to explain that.
Well, the balloon. I have to think about that, but that's a nice analogy to think about.
Okay, yeah, because really, what we do is we live in a three-dimensional space where that fourth dimension is really time. You know, and so as we look back, or as we look back in time, we're looking at the universe when it was smaller and smaller. When we look through space, we see it as it is today. But when we start looking far enough out, we're seeing back in time because the universe was smaller.
When you have that balloon, and you have it up this far, what's beyond it? I mean, the balloon is just this big, so what's beyond?
As far as we in that balloon analogy, everything we see is confined to that surface. So what's out there is the future, because we're going to expand out into that at some point in time. Okay? But it's not, you know, it's not something you can say, well, let's take our telescopes out and look to it, because the only thing we can do is look along the surface of that balloon. You know, we live in a three-dimensional surface of our balloon, so we can look in each of those three dimensions, but that's really the next dimension. That's that fourth time dimension that we can't access except for waiting for it to occur.
All right, we've had a fair discussion right now on the theology of physics. I have three related questions on the physics of theology. Feel
okay.
Free to pick one or all. First, where is heaven? Second, where is hell? Third, we read that time is a characteristic of where we are, yet we also read in Scripture that there appears to be causation and sequencing in heaven. You mm-hmm. have the uprising of Satan and the bad guys who get tossed out. That implies some kind of causation, some kind of sequential activity. Yet for us, at least for me, I think of sequencing and causation as being a characteristic of time. If we have no time, how do we have causation? How do we have sequencing?
I would say the answer to your first two questions is has nowhere we can know. It exists outside of this universe. You know, it seems pretty clear from Scripture that God is going to, at some point in time, destroy this universe and recreate a new universe where those who have chosen to be with Him will reside in that new universe, and those who have chosen not to be with Him will reside outside that universe. So, you know, again, it's not the sort of thing, well, it's kind of over there to the left of that star. You can't identify anywhere in this physical creation, because I believe it's completely external to this physical creation. So that's basically the same answer to both one and two there. Your third question about time and causation, I think what makes the most sense to me is, you know, we live in this universe and we have three spatial dimensions that we're free to move about however we choose. You know, we can go this way, up and down, any combination of those. We live in a fourth dimension, which from a mathematical perspective is basically identical. to those three spatial dimensions, and we call it time. Now, what's unique about that dimension of time is that we can only move in one direction along that single time dimension. And so we can ask that question and say, hey, you know, this thing had a beginning, this thing happened before that, and therefore it caused X. Okay? We can do that. By those principles, you can look back and say, okay, our universe had a beginning. It must have had some transcendent or something beyond that, or beyond the extent of our universe, beyond its capabilities, that was responsible for creating it. Now, what that says is that whatever that being is, or whatever that entity is, or whatever that cause is, must have equivalent access, or access to the equivalent of at least three spatial dimensions, and you need one more to cause ours, and two or one spatial dimension, and probably two to cause ours. Now, if you've got two spatial dimensions, your concept of causality really changes. Simply because, okay, now imagine if we could just simply move back and forth in our time dimension. Okay? Now, I'm standing here today, which, you know, what is it, April 30th, 2006, and I'm 37 years old. Now, if I can move back and forth in this time dimension, I can choose, you know, I'm going to go that way for a while and then come back and do it again. I can come up and be here again when I'm 43. Now, which of those happened first? It's, you know, that your idea of cause and effect is different there. Or maybe, you know, I say, hey, if I've got another time dimension that I could work in, so I go out there and I plant a, you know, some super invention right there. Now, you come back here and you say, oh, that had a beginning. Well, when was the beginning? Was it when I put it there, or was it when I did it? Or your whole idea of how you deal with time is radically different once you've removed the constraint of a unidirectional time dimension, which is what we live in. And so that's maybe a nice way of just avoiding completely answering your question. But I think it's
okay.
The central point is our idea of causality will be radically different once we're removed from that constraint.
So, could Satan change his mind and decide not to rebel after all?
It's a fact. It's done. I don't think so.
But done implies a fixed point in time. I thought you just said, well, I can go away and then I can come back and do it over again.
No, it affects a reality. It's something that was done. But how do you define what time it was?
How do you define done?
It's a reality. I agree. I don't have a good answer for it. That's why I said this is a nice non-answer.
Well, thank you. That was a fun answer.
Well, as corollary to that question, I've always been fascinated by some of the statements that Jesus made, and I couldn't remember exactly where it was, but at one point I think he said, no one is in heaven except the Son of Man who is in heaven. He was speaking to people at the present. Okay. I should have looked that up, because I remember once he stated that he was in heaven at the time, or at least the translations indicate that's what he said.
Okay.
And then also he seemed to have offered to bring the kingdom. He preached about the kingdom a lot, and then he offered it to the community in Jerusalem, which they rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So that what actually was referred to in that term, at least in the text, was some kind of a state of being, a condition or a realm, or being having a different mode of existence under with the Lord, with an expansion of a blessing by the Lord by some means. So rather than being a place or another universe, whether it would be simply a state of being of some kind. And I wish I'd been able to locate the statement that the Lord made to. I'll have to do that later.
Okay. Well, I don't know that this gets directly at what you're saying, but you know, one of the things that it occurs to me, you know, and I remember reading through. I can't remember the exact passage now, where it's talking about you know, the idea was that you're part of the kingdom of heaven, or you will be. The way it said it was important, and I can't remember. But it was basically, you know, that this is now what's going on. And what struck me is that I think a lot of Christians tend, oh, we're going to get to heaven. You know that they're if you look at it measured on our time frame, heaven is in the future. But the moment you decide to trust Christ, you're in the kingdom of heaven. Your identity is set. It's and so as a result, you can experience all the blessings and all the riches which comes with the blessings of Christ there. Now I think in this world it's harder to experience them, but it doesn't mean that they're not there, and it doesn't mean that you're not identified at that. It's not as though, you know, we're not going to get entrance into the kingdom of heaven. We're part of God's family. We are with Him in heaven. We will see that in a different physical way at some point in time in the future, but it doesn't change the reality of what is. You know, and that maybe is some sense an answer to your question over there, Mike, that, you know, it's a reality, but when did it happen? Well, that when did it happen kind of only makes sense when we're talking about this time scale here, but, you know, there seems to be a great mystery to that, that... You know, I think the idea of being able to envision things in multiple time dimensions and kind of begin to ponder those questions gives some insight, but it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, it's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it, that as of right now, we enjoy all the blessings of heaven. Our experience of them may be limited because of our constraints by this world.
That makes sense. There was another question that I failed to make a timely submission yesterday at the event in Orange County, and I've heard answers to it before, but I keep thinking that it somehow could be important to be very clearly aware of, and that is, if in Hebrew, writing a Hebrew text, around 2000 BC, at the language as it was then, how would one express very long periods of time that had definite boundaries, that had commencement and termination, and what words in Hebrew would be used to do that, and how, if any, would they differ from the description of the different days as they're referred to in Genesis?
I know RTV's position is that there was no other word outside of Yom to express a definite but longer than 24-hour period of time. And you see that usage in the Genesis 1, or, yeah. Well, Genesis 2:4, I think it is. So it's not, you know, that's clearly a way of expressing that. Now, whether there are other terms, you know, there are people arguing whether this, or, you know, there's some other term that in later times is used, that's beyond my purvey. But, you know, it seems pretty clear that Yom is one way of expressing that. And our position at RTB is that's what's being expressed in those six creation days.
Well, it just seemed to me that'd be worth thoroughly treating in terms of what is knowable about the Hebrew language at the time the Genesis text apparently originated, to be aware of whether there were any alternatives at all, and how the descriptions that were used might actually be, unavoidably include the notion of long periods of time that might help to resolve mm-hmm. some of the misunderstandings. I'm so impressed with Dr. Lyle, the background he had, and how absolutely fixed he was in his interpretation, and how even his presentation really failed to explore it very mm-hmm. deeply. It had a superficial presentation. Yeah. And how this, and also the sad fact that the majority of the church seems to subscribe to that position, and might help to
lessen the debate. Okay, I offer, you know, two or three things. One is, I think that word that probably has been pretty extensively researched. You know, if there were some other word around that would use, I'm pretty sure that we'd have heard from the young earth community what it was. I mean, because I think that would be a pretty compelling argument that, you know, there were other words to use for this. Why did they use the one that's going to be confusing? You know, so I, if that were out there, I'm pretty sure we'd have heard it. And I know people have done research into that, or else we wouldn't know about yom meaning a 20 or something other than a 24-hour but definite period, and this other word that was used later on in Hebrew usage. So I'm pretty sure that's been researched. But I think one thing that I do want, I was very impressed with Dr. Vardaman's comments during the question and answer, where I forget what the question was, but it was the second to last question. And he was talking about, you know, he asked Hugh, basically, you know, I got permission to ask Hugh what progressive creationism meant. And, you know, Hugh had said, you know, hey, we've kind of distanced ourselves from that term because, you know, theistic evolutionists tend to use that, you know, have kind of commandeered that term for their position. And it was talking about how, you know, we really don't disagree on God's intervention in the history. We disagree on the time scale of the intervention, and we probably disagree on the number of miracles, and that the old earth position probably has more miraculous events in that period. But we don't disagree that God was continually intervening and miraculously working. We just disagree over the time scale. And so after that, Larry Vardaman responded and said, you know, 20 years ago, Hugh and I sat down and we talked about this, and we, you know, we sat down for a number of hours and dialogued, and, you know, we got through, we're Christians, we believe in the authority of Scripture, and we really got down that this was an issue of interpretation. You know, and I have seen, more so from the ICR, a much more, you know, it seems less, you're heretical, that's not a good way to do things. It seems that there's an appreciation that, okay, we're not enemies in this. That there's, you know, we disagree, we can be passionate about that, but there's not an enemies. And my personal take was that Jason Lyle didn't have that same approach. That it seemed that there was much more of an enemy mentality than a, you know, we got significant disagreements, we can dialogue about this, but at the end of the day, we could go watch a movie together, go to a ball game, and have a good time.
Well, I just thought that point might be good to repeat and amplify upon when there are these dialogues to make everyone aware of mm-hmm. the limitations of the language
right.
And the process and the options that are available in interpretation might
yeah.
just help get people to be mm-hmm. more settled, as you mentioned.
Right.
I hope I sound somewhat coherent when I ask this, because I'm having a difficult time, and it's probably so basic. First thing, when the Big Bang occurred, did it occur and expand in a spherical nature or a disc form? Because I've heard the universe is flat. Now, I can show flat in a sphere, I can show flat in a disc. That doesn't bother me.
I will tell you what flat means.
Okay.
Flat means that if I take two parallel beams and shine them out, they will never meet.
Right.
If it's curved and open, those beams will get further away. If it's curved and closed, they will get closer together. It's hard, because what does a three-dimensionally flat surface look like? We can say, okay, I know what a disc looks like, I know how that looks, but that's two-dimensional. I know what a sphere looks like, and that's different, but you can have a two-dimensionally flat or a three-dimensionally flat sphere. I don't think you can ask that question, did it, you know, your balloon analogy fails after a while, because you're looking in a four-dimensional volume, and we look at things three-dimensionally, and it's hard. You can mathematically describe what flat means. You can give a statement of saying, you know, hey, this is what it means in terms of how things interact in that space. But could I give you the shape? No, because it's a four-dimensionally flat universe, and we only know how to deal with three dimensions in terms of visualizing them.
Right.
So you can't really answer that question.
Okay, that brings me to my next point, is can I look out, go up on Mount Wilson, and look in any direction with my telescope and see the original Big Bang?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, you know, and this is related to what we were talking about here. Basically, you know, if we're going to use our balloon analogy again, our balloon is this big. the cosmic microwave background, you know, we see this nice flat picture, but that's really the surface, this globe, we'll say. And so we've got this globe where we have all these temperature fluctuations. Now, if I want to get this, if I want to get this temperature right here, I have to look that way. If I want to get this temperature here, I have to look that way. If I want to get this temperature here, I have to look that way. And so by monitoring all this, or you know, by covering the whole sky, I will get what the whole sky looked like 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So all of every direction I look after 13.73 billion years ago, I'm going to get to the same distance from the Big Bang in time. Does that answer your question?
That's partial. The other part of the question is, and this I think I understand why, correct me if I'm wrong, because of this expansion, this point 7 billion years ago was this far apart from point A and point B, but because of the expansion, it's now 14 billion or whatever.
Right.
It's not that one thing is traveling faster than something else, it's because they're all traveling the same speed, but at a different direction.
The space between them is expanding,
right.
which is the distinction there, and the space is expanding uniformly in all directions as far as we can tell.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to give this another try just to back and forth and see if we can get one step closer to the mind of God. Here's the assumptions. That on the balloon analogy.
The
balloon analogy, okay, is really neat because we're looking back into time as the balloon gets smaller. But the question still comes, how at the surface of my eyeball where the light comes do I get all this history of time? It all has to arrive at my eyeball at the same time. And the only answer I can come up with is that at some time originally, the space fabric at certain places, let's say it all started out at the same speed, the space fabric stretch. But as space fabric kept stretching, the new substance between the cosmological constants, not quintessence, also began to develop stretch. New stretch, new space also entered into the picture, a logarithmic, natural logarithm, if you will. And that means that that certain areas started to stretch faster and continue to start stretch faster, and thus as we look back in time, they're further apart. But that gives me the setup, the foundation, if you will, that some things, all things move apart at different rates because of that stretch. And thus they're going to send back the constant light speed to me from their position that is now moved out in various different positions, and a light 13.7 billion years ago is going to reach me at the same time as one is a million years ago, because they have stretched at different rates, sending the constant light back to me. And I get this privilege of looking in a universe that's probably 350 or so billion light yards years wide now by estimates, but I look back and get 13.7 billion of that containing the whole history, only because space fabric stretched a different rate, sending me out all these points of light that will reach me all at the same time. Now, I don't know if that makes sense. But
I guess if that were true, mm-hmm, we would not see the immense uniformity of the cosmic microwave background. Because what we would see is we would see things moving, in essence, as you're moving faster or slower away, that's going to change your wavelength, change your temperature. And so we would not see this isotropic background that we see. So, I mean, if space were expanding in different speeds at different ways, now you have to thermalize that cosmic microwave background over different times. This thing has to be thermalized with something that was later, which it couldn't communicate with. And so what we see is a universe that at some point in time was in complete causal contact, that everything could communicate and thermalize itself.
I think that's two separate stories. One is a thermalization of at hyperinflation. What I'm talking about is an information transfer.
Even after that, you had to have that thermalization before inflation.
Right.
But now, if after that you expand things at different rates, mm-hmm. effectively what we're doing is that as we look that way, we're looking at a sphere, or we're looking at the universe when it was a little later,
mm-hmm.
or a little earlier. Well, the temperature has been changing continuously through that time.
Let me put it another way. We look at all these surfaces, and we're getting, if you will, an onion peel effect of different expansions, and we measure that expansion by z, the variable of how many times the speed of light something is stretching apart. It's really not a Doppler stretch, which is more a stretching of wavelength. It is a space fabric stretch, and we measure that by z, says Peebles, who wrote the book. And so on astronomy, so we can say that things by z have different z or stretches times the speed of light, and if they do, that has to come from space fabric stretch, and that means they're going to send out their signal, you know, anyway.
Well, but what we can do is we can do two things. Given the redshift, if you want to make your Hubble law diagram, what you have to do is you have to calibrate your distance to that object as well. And so what that says is that I can make the measurement of this redshift here. That tells me how fast it's moving.
Right.
Then I have to make the measurement of what its distance away. And what we find is that if we look that way and we find that something has a redshift of something, or x, which gives its speed, we find it to be a certain distance. Well, if we look that way, we get the same, to the best we can measure,
right.
By other means, every direction we look, we find a certain a certain velocity means a certain distance. And so that's saying that it was a very uniform expansion. And I think ultimately, as you get in and realize what the cosmic microwave background radiation is telling you, is that very clearly tells you that you had to have everything thermalized, or you have to have this remarkable set of coincidences that no matter all this other things that changes the wavelength you would see, somehow at this point in time it all looks identical. And if you're going to have differing expansion rates or not have it thermalized or various other things, it makes it, you have to fine-tune that to 1 part in 10 to the 5, well, which is an immensely difficult thing to do.
I think we have expansion rates that are different and we can have nothing else because the further away we look, the faster things are expanding. That's the story of redshift. Is that not the very proof of a different rate of expansion?
Correct, but if you're going to say, okay, if you're going to have differing rates of expansion, then knowing that velocity and that distance, that tells you the time that you're looking at in the history of the universe as well.
Okay.
And so if I see this velocity and that distance, but that gives me the universe when it was 1 billion years old, and then I look over here and I see a velocity and a distance, and that now gives me the universe when it was 0.5 billion years old, for some reason, when I look at it, I see the same temperature on those two. And so that means that the temperature of the universe when it was 1 billion had to match the temperature when it was universe of 0.5 billion. But what we see is that how would you make that happen unless if what you're really seeing is at the same time and they were all in thermal equilibrium. That's the most compelling explanation.
Thank you. I'll think on that. Appreciate it.
Theological question.
Okay.
If people choose to reject Christ, will they understand the magnitude of that decision, or will it be too painful to endure?
Everything I've read, all the respectable conservative theologians I've heard, basically say that at the end of the day, not only or at the end of the time, there seems to be this indication that we're actually going to be there. At the Great White Throne Judgment, where we see, people will see what's going on. And so, yes, it is it's not, oh, you chose wrongly, I'm going to wipe you out so you don't have to suffer for eternity. It seems very much that, yes, they will recognize and that they will appreciate that this was the wrong way. That seems what the description of the Bible says it is, and people agree that that's the case, and so therefore that's good.
Jeff, we probably should make this the last question. We have the privilege of hearing from Hugh every week, and it's really wonderful, and I'd like to ask you a personal question. Given the whole field of astronomy and astrophysics, for you, what is the most compelling evidence for the God of the Bible? What's the one thing that really touches you?
Oh, for me personally?
Yeah.
I don't know that I could identify a single piece of evidence, and I think my impression is that that's, you know, any single piece of evidence you could probably explain. What I think is the most compelling evidence is that multiple different disciplines within astronomy are all coming up with different ways of saying that there's a God. But we don't want that. Here's a way of explaining it without, you know. And so you look at it, and you can't make it all work unless that's true. So it's really a here's all the evidence, and taken in that light, it's hard to get around. Whereas, you know, I could find you know, if you just had to worry about the beginning and the fine tuning, well, okay, that's you know, multiverse has a good chance at explaining that, and that's pretty reasonable, and it's just as, you know, somewhat as speculative as anything else that's out there. So I could find a reason to not believe any given piece of evidence. But it really is, it's the weight of the evidence and the fact that it corresponds so well with what we find in Scripture.
Yeah, that's good.
Again, it's not quite an answer to your question, but...
Charlie's got one more question. Sure. We'll make that the last one.
Could you describe the work that you're doing at UCLA and where it could lead and what the impact of it is and might be?
What I work on is I look at high-energy gamma-ray objects, which high-energy, or actually is the technical term is very high-energy, but electromagnetic radiation has an energy to it, and if this light has an energy of 1, X-rays have an energy of about 10,000, the gamma rays I look at have an energy of 100 billion to a trillion. You know, so they're way up there. What I think is fascinating about it is that to produce those sorts of energies, those are the things that we've just begun over the past 10 years to be able to produce those in our particle accelerators. And so these are extreme environments in the universe, neutron stars, black holes, colliding galaxies, these sorts of things. Where will that lead? It impinges on a number of things. One, you're looking at these things over a great distance of the universe, and so it turns out that one of the fogs that we have to look through is this infrared background. There's a bunch of just starlight out there, and this infrared light reacts with these photons that we want to detect and scatters them so we can't see them anymore. And so that has impact for maybe understanding where, you know, how all the starlight is, or, you know, how the history of the starlight of the universe. It has impact in measuring what's going on in our in the galactic center. You know, we can measure gamma rays coming from the center of our galaxy. So its main function is to give us more tools into understanding, quasars for one. If you want to go out and look at these types of objects, the bulk of their energy very often is emitted in gamma rays. And so it's like saying, okay, I want to go out and look at the ocean, but I'm only going to look at the bay out here in Santa Monica. Well, that's important, but there's a whole lot more out there that if you want to understand things, you got to know. So it's... My particular area of astronomy I would much more characterize as we want to understand how these objects work, they fit into the universe, and so that's kind of what it does. I wouldn't say it has this, oh, great apologetic value. Some areas do much more. I would say, you know, galaxy mergers, that has impact for apologetic value. The microwave background, that has impact and apologetic value. I mean, very immediate impact and apologetic value. The stuff I do is just kind of interesting because you're looking at extreme environments in the universe that we could never reproduce here on the Earth. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it, yeah.